Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us this morning. Today on the program, in this first hour, we will invite your questions about diet and nutrition. And our guest is Claire Hassler. She's been here before on the show. She's director of the Functional Foods for Health program here at the University of Illinois, the nation's first scientific program devoted to the study of how components of food may prevent disease and also promote health. I've never mentioned your qualifications before, so I think I'm going to do this time around. She holds dual PhDs in environmental toxicology and human nutrition. She went to school at Michigan State. After that, she was a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory of cellular carcinogenesis and tumor promotion at the National Cancer Institute. And then since 1992 has been director of the Functional Foods for Health program. And her particular interest, or at least a main interest, is the role that soy might play in chronic disease prevention. And we'll talk a little bit about that and take other questions, too. I know that she will do her best to answer your questions. And as we all always tell guests, if you don't have an answer, say, that's a fine question, but I can't answer it for you, and then we'll just go on. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Well, thanks for being here.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure to be back.
We can look at a few things that are new. One of the things I think is difficult for people is a lot of claims are made about benefits of particular kind of things, and it's hard to know sometimes, is there justification for that claim? And the government agencies like the USDA does try to evaluate some of these claims. And apparently there has been some news recently on the issue of omega-3 fatty acid, which is a kind of stuff, basically it's in fish.
That's correct.
And this is not particularly new, but I think some people have been promoting the idea that eating more fish is good for you. And now I guess the government has said, depending on how you make that claim, one may make a claim that we think that there probably is some relationship between omega-3 fatty acid and lowering risk of heart disease. What now do we think we know about this particular stuff?
Well, a couple of things have happened recently. In the most recent American Heart Association 2000 guidelines for health, they have for the first time recommended 2 fish meals per week for heart health. So that's a big change. It's long been known that the consumption of deep water fish such as mackerel, cod, sardines, those fish that reside in very cold temperatures, may have a benefit for heart health. The FDA declined in 1993 to allow a health claim on food labels for that diet-disease relationship because the data was conflicting. And when I say conflicting, I mean in some cases, omega-3s actually increase the level of low-density lipoprotein or the bad cholesterol. And that type of cholesterol is the type of cholesterol that the FDA wants to see reduced when we consume so-called functional foods such as fish or soy or whatever. But there have been some large-scale studies that show that incidence of myocardial infarction, heart attacks, other heart endpoints are improved by consuming fish. So just within the last 3 months, in October, in fact, the FDA is now allowing a qualified health claim on dietary supplements, and I expect that's going to pertain to conventional foods in the future. They believe there's some evidence to support consuming fish for heart health, but the data is still somewhat conflicting. And so they're allowing certain statements on dietary supplements. But again, the American Heart Association, who I believe is the most reputable body for setting heart health guidelines, has recommended 2 fish meals a week for heart health.
People in the nutrition field, I think, always have said, what we'd like you to do is get these things in your food rather than take a pill. Now, it is possible you can go out and you can buy omega-3 fatty acid in a capsule. Depending on how you feel about fish or whether you feel, well, like you really can't eat that much fish, do you get the same benefit if you go and you do this as a supplement?
There are many studies that support that you can get those benefits from supplements. In general, when you compare supplements to foods, the issue is, are there other things in foods that might support the health benefit that you would not get if you took that in an isolated supplement. That's the case most of the time. However, having said that, there have been many studies that have shown that consuming supplements of fish oil capsules can reduce triglycerides, may prevent a second heart attack, things like that. And many of these large-scale studies have actually used dietary supplements. Some have used foods. So in this case, supplements may be okay. I still recommend consumption of foods.
Mm. And here again, are we talking about particular kinds of fish, or is this for any fish?
No, it's those kinds of fish that have high amounts of omega-3 fatty acids. And again, those are the fatty fish that reside in deep waters, such as cod, mackerel, sardines, those kinds of fish, salmon, for example, those kinds of fatty fish that you can purchase in the grocery store and often may choose to consume at a restaurant, for example.
Okay. Our guest this morning here in this first hour of Focus 580 is Claire Hassler. She's director of the Functional Foods for Health program at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about nutrition. If you have questions, you can call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And here's a caller in Clifton on our line number four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I was thinking maybe your logo is be good to your heart, eat fish.
That's anyway, a good thing.
Well, I don't know if somebody wants to pick up on that or not. I know salmon is bad news to me. I was eating at my daughter's one time, and the next morning I had gout in my left hands and wrist. But anyway, and that's a fatty fish.
Yes,
it's in the cold water.
Yes. These are fatty fish that reside in fairly cold water temperatures that have those kinds of fats in them that have been associated with heart health benefits.
Well, I love the cod.
Yes.
You mentioned that.
That is one of them.
What I specifically wanted to ask you was I'm afflicted with diabetes type 2,
mm-hmm.
and any sores that I have are very slow to heal. Would your soy or any of these items be better in my diet, perhaps? I know I need to I'm just waiting for the warm weather so I can get out in my garden, and I know a lot of my troubles are going to go away then. But in the meantime, is there something you'd suggest in a diet for people with diabetes too, or is that in your repertoire?
Well, in general, you should be under the counsel of a physician or ideally a registered dietitian that works to provide diets for individuals like yourself that have type 2 diabetes. And typically type 2 diabetes is associated or occurs in older adults, and oftentimes if those individuals are overweight, and it's hard for me to make an assessment just speaking to you on the radio about your weight, your lifestyle habits, etc. But you did ask about soy, and certainly the most well-known benefit of soy is for heart health, but there is some data that is emerging that soy may lower blood glucose levels. So there are a number of foods, and as I said before, if you haven't or aren't following a diet to monitor your blood glucose, you should be, and there are dietitians that can help you do that. Soy has been shown to reduce blood glucose, so certainly that might be a beneficial food to add to your diet.
Clara, thank you very much. I'm being monitored by a good physician, at least I think he is.
Okay.
And you hit it on the nail on the head. I'm somewhat obese, elderly fellow, old enough to have flown missions on a B-24 bomber.
Bless your heart.
I've been around a little while, but I'd like to stay around a while longer.
Well, it's never too late to start a low impact exercise program, even for elderly individuals, walking or swimming, things that you can do that you enjoy, anything to get your heart in good shape, and also will help with your calorie expenditure and help with your weight.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for the call.
I don't want to use your time up because I know you will have other callers, and we wish you all well.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. In anticipating your being here, I went through some recent papers looking for various things we could talk about. Mm-hmm. And I just maybe at this point it would be worth mentioning the fact that at both obesity in the United States and diabetes are on the rise, and those two things certainly are linked.
Absolutely.
Diabetes in the United States rose by about 6%. In 1999, the rise, I'm here reading from a newspaper story, the rise blamed largely on obesity, which was up startling 57% from 1991. And what's another thing in the story that's really striking, as you mentioned, the type 2 diabetes tends to be something that you see in older people, I guess maybe like over 50.
Well, I don't know if I can quote an age range, but tends to be type 1 diabetes. It tends to be that which appears in childhood, and you need to have insulin to regulate your blood glucose level. But I mean, my theory on this, and this is not something that hasn't been mentioned by many people before, is we just don't move enough. We sit at the computer, we surf the internet, we use the remote to change the television channel. There was a eminent nutritionist in the Division of Nutritional Sciences that gave a seminar a couple of years ago that calculated that just not getting up from the couch and changing the channel, they've calculated that decreases or can contribute to a pound of weight gain a year. And that's just one minor example. So that, I think, is the most important factor, that we are sedentary. And that's has implications not only for obesity, but for people who are prone to cancer. Breast cancer in women has been shown to be dramatically reduced by aerobic activity, maybe even colon cancer. So we need to move. And it doesn't have to be running a marathon. It can be parking away from your building and walking from there to your building, parking in a remote lot, or walking in the morning. But I really feel strongly that's important in terms of the increasing incidence of obesity and diabetes.
Yeah, this particular story quoted an epidemiologist from the Centers for Disease Control that basically said the very thing that you did. And what's particularly striking is this, he says, talking about the type 2 diabetes, he says that used to be a disease that came late in life. Now it's coming in kids as young as the early 20s. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly something to be concerned about. And he said the very thing that, you need to lose weight. And the way to do that is to look at your diet and increase your physical activity.
Right.
It's not really that hard. Well, it's hard to do. It's one of those things we all know what's good for us, but do we do it? Well,
and we have less and less free time, and carving out 30 to 60 minutes a day, and that's what major public health organizations are recommending, the USDA, the American Heart Association, rather than two, three times a week. Every day you should be getting 30 to 60 minutes of aerobic exercise, and that's difficult for people who have priorities that are not in line with that.
Sure. Well, let's talk with some other folks, and we have a couple of callers in Urbana. We'll start to hear with line one.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, you mentioned deep water fish like salmon and cod, but most of the time you don't get them actually deep water fish, but they're farm-raised. Is that as effective as actual fish that grows in nature?
Certainly those same types of fish would still contain those omega-3 fatty acids, whether they're naturally residing in those waters or whether they're farm-raised. And I realize that incorporating fish into the diet is probably a little more difficult because it takes a little more active searching out or changing your diet. But so you can get those same benefits from fish that are farm-raised if there are the types of fish that I mentioned.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. And to line number two, this is also Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
A vegetarian question.
Mm-hmm.
I read recently that miso has been found to have traces of B12, which,
yes,
as you know, is problematic for vegetarians. I was just wondering if You knew anything about that?
Yes, it does. And some other things, brewer's yeast and some other things have B12. And certainly we know that vegans, that is those individuals who consume no animal products whatsoever, are at risk for a vitamin B12 deficiency. The question is whether you would consume enough miso to get the B12 required.
Right.
It's probably a good idea if you're a vegan completely to be taking a dietary supplement once a day that contains B12 in it.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. And again, to another Urbana person, this is line 3. Hello.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. First of all, I just heard briefly yesterday, listening to your station, reference to the possibility of some study has come out to the effect that consumption of soy has some sort of a connection with Alzheimer's, and I'd like to know what your opinions are of that. And the other is there's the danger. Is tuna bad because of the possibility that it may have unacceptable levels of mercury in it?
Well, I will answer your first question first because this is a real pet peeve of mine. This study on the soy connection with Alzheimer's disease came out some months ago. I believe it was in the spring of last year, and that data was first presented at a meeting in Washington in November of 99. Let me say that there was an association in a study conducted in Hawaii of Asian men who, and the study's investigator, Dr. Lon White, found that those men who consumed tofu 2 or more times a week had an increase in Alzheimer's disease. Let me also say, though, that number one, this is only one study. It's not a clinical intervention study. That is, these men were not fed a soy component or tofu and fed and followed forward over time. This is a kind of study that you cannot determine a cause and effect because it was looking at these men's diets many, many years prior when they consumed tofu in the 1960s and 1970s and doing an assessment of their mental function now. It had a number of limitations in the study, which I won't go into on this program. I have many people feel also that it's an interesting observation, but nothing more than that at this point, unless we clearly see many more studies that support this. And the fact of the matter is Asian men tend to have, they live longer and they don't tend to have any more incidence of Alzheimer's disease and consume tofu in their diet. And in fact, the estrogens in soy products tend to perhaps have a positive benefit on mental function. So I would say that it's a study, one study only. It got an awful lot of negative, I should say, press for the fact that it was only one study, and I wouldn't put a lot of credence in it. Now, to your second question about tofu, tuna and mercury, it's hard to answer that question. There have been concerns in terms of consumption of fish that have a lot of heavy metals in them. I would say if one knew that the source of the fish that they were consuming was contaminated with a lot of heavy metals, for goodness sakes, don't consume them. And there are certain areas in the Great Lakes, for example, where I grew up, that was a problem in certain time periods. It certainly, if you knew that that was the case, you should avoid that. But you certainly can't say that tuna across the board has high levels of mercury. That's just not the case.
There's no way of being able to tell when you buy canned tuna, for example.
No, you can't. You would have to send it to a laboratory that assesses for metals and have them do that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You'd think, given the fact that people in Asia consume a lot of soy, more than Americans do, that if there was some sort of relationship between soy and Alzheimer's, we'd see, for example, in Japanese people, a much higher level of Alzheimer's disease.
And they live much longer. They have the longest longevity of any ethnic group on the planet. And also there are other groups such as Seventh-day Adventists, vegetarians, have been consuming large amounts of soy. This simply isn't something we've ever noted before, which is why I say it's a blip, so to speak, on the radar screen, this study. And there are a number of other limitations with the study design that people have criticized also. But it's still out there. I see it on the Internet all the time, and I've commented on it also publicly many times.
Okay. What another study that I thought I'd ask you about, this one, I believe, if I remember right, came from Australia, where they found that if people who were already consuming lean meat, if they replaced the lean meat with tofu, that again, what you see is you lower those individuals' risk of heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the things I wondered about that is how much of this is the fact that the meat's coming out of the diet, so one presumes that does cut the dietary intake of fat, even though it was lean meat, and how much of this does have to do with the soy itself?
Well, my comments on that are a couple. I'd have to look at the study design to see if there was appropriate, you know, lead-in period and intervention period to determine whether, in fact, it was a true effect of the tofu. Lean meat can be incorporated into the diet and, in fact, has been shown to be fine in terms of heart health. And I've already stated that there's been many, many studies that have shown that soy incorporation in the diet lowers the risk for heart disease. That's why we have a health claim on food label. So this, what you've told me, is not surprising. It would be hard for me, unless I really looked at the study design, to determine whether it was just a replacement effect of soy for meat. I don't know if they just added it on top of meat. But it's not surprising that they would have an additional effect, because meat, even if it's lean, contains saturated fat. Even if you are looking at the outside and you see no extraneous fat, there is marbling throughout the meat, which has saturated fat in it. And saturated fat is the most important component of the diet that leads to high cholesterol.
We're about midway through this part of Focus. Our guest is Claire Hassler. She is the director of the Functional Foods for Health program at the University of Illinois. This is a program that,
I need to correct you on that. Associate director as of July.
Okay.
So previous executive director, associate director.
Well, it's still, ladies and gentlemen, the nation's first full-scale and only full-scale scientific program devoted to the study of how components of food may prevent disease and promote health. And as we have discussed here, particular interest of hers is the relationship between soy in the diet and prevention of chronic disease, particularly heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have questions about that, that's fine. But it's not just about soy if you have other kinds of nutrition questions.
Can I put a plug in for a study?
You bet.
We are screening African-American women right now at the university. There's never been a study that's looked specifically at African-American women with high cholesterol and the effect that soy may play in improving heart health and other benefits. And we are currently looking for African-American women who are premenopausal and who have high cholesterol. And if you feel you fit into that criteria, we'd love it if you'd call the office and let us know that you want to have us screen your cholesterol and see if you participate. And you can call my office at 333-6364. And the project coordinator's name on that study is Robin Swindle.
Okay, very good.
Thanks.
And we have other callers. Southern Illinois next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How you doing? I'll make this quick. I got three quick questions. We farm down here in Southern Illinois, and we raise a lot of soybeans. And I've been thinking about consuming soybeans. Is that where the soy that you're talking about comes from, soybeans?
Yes, those are the soybeans that we grow in Illinois. We are the largest producer, as you know, in the United States of that. And the soy that's commercially available does come from soy grown on farms like yours.
Now, one concern is soybeans are pretty high in saturated fats, correct?
No, they're not.
They're not?
Soy is not a bean that's high in saturated fat, and that's one of the reasons that we think it is a good source of protein to incorporate in the diet. Most of the fat in soybeans are of the monounsaturated, like you would find in olive oil, or unsaturated, like you would find in other types of oils.
Okay, I think I worded that wrongly. It's high in oil, just like a peanut would be.
That's correct.
Is that bad for you at all? I mean, how?
Well, we want people to reduce their fat overall. But what's becoming clear in the last decade or so is that the type of fat may be as important as how much fat. So one can even incorporate fat from walnuts and other kinds of nuts in the diet, as long as your dietary fat overall is not more than 30% of calories. And the type of fat, as I said, in some of these other plant products such as soy and walnuts and the like, are because they're not saturated fat, have been shown to either not raise your cholesterol or may even lower it.
So now, if a person wanted to consume beans, the soybeans, once a week would be fairly decent, or would you prefer more than that?
We would prefer more than that, and the Food and Drug Administration has, since 1999, September, allowed a health claim on food labels, and that is based on the intake of 25 grams of soy protein a day. And so we would want people to consume that on a daily basis, and one can easily get that from commercially available foods on the market, because since the health claim has been allowed, many more food products are coming into the marketplace that have high levels of soy protein in them.
I see. One other thing, and I'll let you go. We spray a lot of these beans with chemicals and stuff, so people have to kind of be thoughtful on the concern that they're not really organically grown in that sense, because we couldn't really.
Mm-hmm.
But I would encourage more people to eat them. It'd certainly help us out since their prices are so low. But I had heard that people who consume salads with vinegar on it, that helps break up the cholesterol within the veins and stuff. I'll let you go and see what you have to say. Thank you.
Okay.
I don't think there's any physiological reason that vinegar would break up cholesterol. I mean, cholesterol is metabolized in the body like any other, similar to other types of fats, and there's not real good evidence to suggest that consuming certain types of foods may help break fats down. It's more important to monitor your level of fat intake. Certainly mentioning salads is important because we want people to consume lots and lots of fruits and vegetables every day, and high grains and a low-fat diet.
On again, to back here to someone locally in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I got a couple questions. I'm not sure whether you can address the first one. Do you know anything much about the measures that were taken to protect our food supply from BSE coming from Europe? Like I just heard yesterday, last night on the news, that in France they traced quite a lot of or some of the BSE contamination to exports from England to first Ireland and then Belgium and then from those two places to the continent.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard so little about what they've done to protect our food supplies. I'm wondering if you could expand on it at all.
Well, let me say that this is not my area of expertise, but I can say that even with the concern that has been increasing in Europe, there have been very, very, very few documented cases of BSE affecting humans. Having said that, though, it's something that the European population is concerned about because cattle are contaminated. As far as I know, and again, I'm not the expert on this, there have been rightly no concern in this country because we haven't seen outbreaks of this to a significant extent in the U.S. And let me just leave you by saying this is not my area of expertise. So there are probably better sources, and I could certainly refer you to some people who can answer that question better than I can.
Maybe we should try and find somebody else and do another show,
yeah.
I guess.
That would be a good show to do, actually.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, well, I've heard that a lot of foods carry meat products in them that you wouldn't think.
Well, they do. There are many foods that have meat byproducts, but again, the food regulations in this country are very, very stringent, and our food supply is very safe. There is, a concern in Europe because they have had some outbreaks in their cattle population there, but I don't think we have a problem in the U.S.
Well, I was thinking more specifically about like imported chocolates, little biscuits from Europe, that kind of thing. But let me move on to my other question. And that kind of ties into what you were talking about with diabetes and obesity. And that is that I've heard that one way to look at one of the problems with food with diabetes and obesity is the glycemic load.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and which basically apparently puts a red flag on rice and potatoes, and that they create a high glycemic load for people. And I wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about that. And then can you tell me, is it true that basmati rice in particular has a lower glycemic load?
Let me clarify what you just said, because the glycemic, it's called glycemic index, and that is simply a measure of how fast your blood glucose comes up after you consume a diet or a food. And then when your blood glucose goes up, you have the hormone insulin that is activated and transports that glucose into the cell and brings your glucose back down. In fact, rice and potatoes and complex carbohydrates have a reduced glycemic index, not an increased glycemic index. It's the simple sugars, processed foods that contain cookies, things like that, that would tend to have an adverse effect on blood glucose. So I want to be clear that complex carbohydrates from legumes, from rice, from potatoes have a reduced effect on glycemic index, and different foods have a different effect on that. Basmati rice, I don't have the information to know whether that would reduce the glycemic index more than other types of rice. But in general, these complex carbohydrates have a beneficial effect on blood glucose effects.
That's a little troubling because I'm looking at an article from a press release about the glycemic index from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and it says, quote, "While many carbohydrates such as rice and potatoes have high glycemic indices and cause a dramatic rise in glucose and insulin 2 to 3 hours after eating," and then it goes on about beans and legumes is not so bad. So, but anyway, thanks.
I'll have to check that out when I get back to the office. But in general, for food categories, you're certainly right that legumes and beans have a damping effect. And I would suspect that rice and potatoes are intermediate, but the simple sugars from processed foods tend to have the most adverse effect on blood glucose. Mm.
I do recall having interviewed someone, and my apologies, I can't remember the name, but it was somebody who had advanced a particular diet for people who had diabetes and claimed that some people, if they follow this diet, actually were able to not stop taking insulin. Mm-hmm. And it was, when I looked at it, I thought, well, what is it you can eat? Because it was severely restricted. You couldn't eat potatoes, you couldn't eat rice, you couldn't eat bread, you couldn't eat pasta. There didn't seem to leave very much. But the claim was that some people who had previously had to take insulin by following this diet were able to regulate their blood sugar without.
Well, certainly we know, as I said to the gentleman that called in before, in many cases, those people that are overweight and when they become overweight need to start taking insulin, and then when they get their weight in the ideal range, start exercising, which helps that, of course, they are often able to go off insulin. Mm. So that is a huge benefit, because consuming insulin has some long-term effects that are maybe adverse. So if there's any way people can get themselves off insulin by getting their weight in the ideal range and becoming more active, that's a beneficial effect.
Okay. Other callers. Let's go to another Urbana person here. Line two. Hello.
Yes. I'm very interested to hear this program on soy. I regularly was taking about 6 ounces of tofu a day, and then I heard this Alzheimer's thing, and I stopped abruptly. If I take 6 ounces of this, you know, this more new tofu stuff, is that sufficient? Am I getting sufficient grams a day?
You need to look at the label. Everybody should be reading food labels, and the only source of protein in tofu would be from soy. So it should state on the label. If it doesn't, then there are some general guidelines for tofu that we can provide for you. But 6 ounces is probably not quite enough. I don't have at the top of my head the amount of protein in 6 ounces of tofu, but that information should be on the package label, and you could simply check that by seeing how many grams of protein per serving that particular tofu provides.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go back here to the next person, and I think that'd be line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Earlier you were talking about fatty fish. Are herring considered a fatty fish?
Yes.
And is it a problem if they're smoked?
Well, that's a bit of a complicated issue. There's evidence to suggest that the consumption of smoked foods in general and salted foods tends to increase one's risk for stomach cancer. And the reason that stomach cancer has gone down so dramatically in this country since the 1920s is because we don't tend to consume a lot of smoked fish. We don't need to preserve our food that way because we have refrigeration and other mechanisms to do that. So it totally depends on how much of this you would be consuming. If you're consuming all of your protein sources from smoked foods, that would not be a good dietary practice, but occasionally would be fine.
Yeah, about twice a week.
I think that's probably okay.
Okay. And another question on soy protein. I used to, in accordance with the container, which recommends 3 heaping tablespoons of soy protein, and I was putting it on cereal.
Mm-hmm.
And I attended a training session not too long ago on diabetes, and I showed the container to the nurse, and she said, that has 24 grams of protein. That's way too much protein. You ought to cut back to maybe 1 tablespoon. And I want to get your thoughts
mm-hmm.
on that.
Well, it depends on the amount of protein that you're consuming in your diet. If that's the only source of protein you're consuming in your diet, which I find hard to believe for a man, then that's certainly not going to be a problem. I don't know what your...
I have a normal diet with plenty of protein.
Yeah. So replacing some of your protein with soy is actually going to have some potential benefit on a number of heart indices and also blood glucose. Again, I think that was a bit of an overreaction, although if it depends on the amount of protein you would be consuming in your diet. Typically, a man would be consuming 80 to 100 grams. You may be on somewhat of a protein-restricted diet for some reason. I can't answer that, but I think that was probably a bit of an overreaction.
Oh, okay. So you think a normal diet would be about 80 to 100?
Well, the amount of protein that an individual needs is 0.8 grams per kilogram of ideal body weight. In order to get kilograms, you divide your ideal body weight by 2.2 and then multiply that number by 0.8. And that's an ideal sort of level of protein. If you're a very active athlete, you would need more than that. But we in general in the U.S. consume far more protein than we really require. Again, I'd have to look at your dietary intake to see what you're currently consuming. But you can easily figure that out by finding out your weight in kilograms, multiplying if you are, in fact, at your ideal body weight, and multiplying that number by 0.8, and that's about the amount of protein that you need per day.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. We have 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Claire Hassler. She's the Associate Director of the Functional Foods for Health Program at University of Illinois. We're talking about diet and nutrition. And if you have questions, you can call in. I know she'll do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller here is in Chicago, line 4.
Thank you. I believe it was Barry Sears in his book, The Zone, that brought up the glycemic controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And he has written a book recently. It's called The Soy Zone.
Yep.
I don't know if you had a chance to review or look at it.
I'm aware of it. I haven't read it yet.
Uh-huh. Well, but apparently he's leaning more towards soy as an alternative also. But recently I heard something to the effect that there's a bright side to soy and a dark side, and that's this. It should be fermented soy that's preferable. Now, I heard this recently by a health alternative advocate who has a program called Leading Cutting Edge Medicine and so forth on the net somewhere. And he was on the radio, and he said that there's a bright side and dark side to it. So I don't know if you've looked into that, that fermented soy is preferable. So it's something to think about and look into, as well as the glycemic matter on potatoes and rice.
And what did he I mean, I'm fully aware of the information that's been floating about in not scientific sources on the sort of dark side of soy. But let me just say that the health claim that's been set by the FDA for heart health is based on soy protein. So in general, and all of this is a good message for all of us, is we need to be aware of the of our own health needs and what types of foods we should be consuming to meet those needs. If one's concern is for reducing cholesterol that's moderately elevated, then fermented or no, it's the soy protein that one needs to be consuming, in addition to other heart-healthy foods. Soy is not the only food that has a health claim. There are health claims for oats. There are health claims for the margarines that are on the market that have plant sterols in them. And there are foods that are good for the heart that still don't have health claims yet but may in the future.
One more comment, please. Along with the controversy about the group in Hawaii, the Japanese people that had the problem, there's also another study that said that excessive vitamin C reduced the blood flow of the carotid artery. Had you heard anything about that one?
I've seen that study. There is are some groups that are suggesting that we maybe shouldn't be consuming more than 500 milligrams a day of vitamin C. Certainly, we know that the current RDI, or recommended dietary intake for vitamin C, is probably not high enough for smokers or for those who are under oxidative stress. Perhaps they should be consuming as much as 200 milligrams of vitamin C. So that's a bit of an area of controversy. And again, it depends on the level. But there have been many studies that show that much higher levels than even 5 milligrams may have some benefits on other oxidative related diseases like Alzheimer's disease. So, yes, I'm aware of that study, and there are not a huge number of studies to support that.
Some antioxidants can be effective, but they can also be a pro-oxidant.
That's correct. And, in fact, a good example of that is the beta-carotene intervention study was conducted in Finland, where individuals who were at very high risk for lung cancer consumed a lot of beta-carotene, and in fact, instead of having a reduced risk of lung cancer, they actually had more lung cancer, and beta-carotene was... So I think a message from this might be, rather than focusing on dietary supplements, which are a defined component, to focus on a dietary pattern, which contains many, many beneficial things.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. To line one here, Urbana. Hello.
Hello. What is the easiest way to get 25 grams of soy protein in your diet a day?
Well, there's many ways to do that. One easy and convenient way is to consume a handful of soy nuts. Roasted soy nuts can be purchased in many food stores and natural health markets in the Champaign-Urbana area. A half a cup may have upwards of 15 grams of soy protein. Now, there's a significant amount of calories in that, so that may not be a benefit for everyone. You can also consume the soy milk, which may have upwards of 8 or 10 grams of soy protein in addition to tofu, which you can incorporate into smoothies, into casserole dishes. There are also a variety of meat alternative burgers in the grocer's frozen section that can be easily consumed that may provide 11 to 12 to 15 grams of soy protein. So a combination of a number of things. There are also some good sports bars or supplement bars that you can consume that have 14, 15, 16 grams of soy protein that are convenient and a good snack as alternative to chocolate bar, for example.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks.
Can you give me a name of one of those sports bars?
Prefer not to do that over the air.
Okay, thanks for the call. One thing we did, I thought we might talk a little bit about, I just mentioned it real quick, that there apparently now are a couple of margarines.
Yes.
Where they're adding this stuff.
Right.
And I guess it makes me think that in future, if we're really sure that there is this beneficial relationship mm-hmm. with this stuff, that in more processed foods, perhaps we may see soy protein added,
yeah.
So that there will be maybe a little bit easier to get more of it in the diet.
Yeah, and we're seeing that already. Since the health claim's been approved, a number of companies have started adding soy into their products or developed new products. But just to expound on the margarine issue, in September of last year, the Food and Drug Administration approved a health claim for what we call plant sterols, phytosterols, in a couple of margarines on the market. So if you go into a grocery store, you'll see these margarines in the grocery shelves that have a big heart on them, and they say may reduce your risk of heart disease. And these margarines, which can be substituted for either butter or regular margarine, actually have a component added to them that have been shown to be very, very effective in lowering cholesterol, and as much as 20 to 25% in some cases. So for those individuals who have a moderately elevated cholesterol and are not on drugs and are looking for additional ways to purchase foods in the marketplace that can help their cholesterol, certainly this is an alternative. They tend to be a bit expensive. That is a downside for some people, but their taste is good. And again, if you substitute that for margarine or regular margarine or butter, you may have an impact on your cholesterol level.
Okay, we'll try and do at least one more here in Urbana, and that's line number two. Hello.
Just ran across a soy cereal that I've bought but haven't opened yet. It's Soyos. So I don't know what they taste like, but the sample in the store actually tastes pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It says 8 grams of...
Per serving?
Let me just check. Oh, 12 grams.
Yeah, and if you had a serving of that, actually what tastes a really good use for soy milk, which some people don't like, is on whole grain cereal because it naturally has a nutty, beany flavor anyway, and in fact, the vanilla type. So that kind of combination of a soy-based cereal with a soy milk, you could probably get your 25 grams a day, perhaps in one meal.
My question, though, is about natural source vitamins versus non-natural source vitamins. Somebody whose wife was a nurse was telling me that she'd been to a workshop where they said that this was important to get natural sourced vitamins. The only one that I've run across where there's a chemical difference, and I haven't been looking real hard, is with vitamin E.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to get D-alpha
right.
Overall. Are there other vitamins where it really is important to have... the natural source?
Well, there are certain other types of vitamins or minerals that might be more bioavailable to the body, meaning the body absorbs it more readily. Calcium, for example, there tend to be different sources of calcium that you may absorb to a greater extent because we don't absorb our vitamins and minerals to 100%. The calcium, for example, in orange juices, certain orange juices on the market tend to be almost more bioavailable or absorbable than those in dietary supplements. Another reason. And then folate or folic acid from dietary supplements tends to be a good source of folate. So there is some instances in which different formulations are more bioavailable. You can't say it across the board, however.
We're going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. I'm sorry there's some people we can't take. But in future, I'm sure Claire will come back again and maybe we'll do this on this show. And, of course, on the Afternoon Magazine, they do a show on nutrition every month, so there's an opportunity to ask questions. And if you're interested also in the Functional Foods for Health program and you have access to the Internet, they have a website. You can go there and see what they're up to.
Right. And do I need to give you the URL, which is extremely lengthy?
Let me give it a try.
Okay. www.ag.uiuc.edu/FFH/FFH.
I told you it was...
I think you can get into it if you go into the College of Agriculture website.
Exactly. Go to the U of I main page, go to the College of Agriculture, go there.
Probably easier to do that.
All right. Claire Hassler.
The next time we come back, I'll know my glycemic index a little bit
better. Thanks. Claire Hassler is Associate Director of the Functional Foods for Health Program, University of Illinois.